Good evening. It's good to see each one of you. I'm delighted that Professor Ibrahim Abu-Rabi is with us this evening. He is the ECMC Chair in Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta. And he's come here from teaching for many years at Hartford Seminary and having the chair on Muslim-Christian dialogue at Hartford. A number of you have heard Professor Abu-Rabi before, a year or so ago, I believe. He's written a couple more books since then. He has a real problem. But he did bring a few copies of the Contemporary Arab Reader on Political Islam, if any of you are interested, and you ought to be, which he edits and introduces. And it's got a whole set of essays in it which speak to the range of movements that are at work in our world today around political Islam. So it's lovely to have you here. I've had the pleasure of traveling with Ibrahim to Syria and Turkey. A pleasure that I would, you know, invite you to join in.
Don't forget Jordan, too.
And Jordan. We're at Jordan. So we have wrestled with the camels. So this evening he's going to speak about the roots of political Islam a bit. But as some of you may be aware, things have been happening in Egypt. So we were unable not to bring that to the table. So you're going to get two for one tonight. We're going to speak about Egypt as well.
Maybe see about the time, if it's a little bit longer. Or, yeah.
We're going to, Ibrahim will lecture for about an hour, and then we'll open it up for questions, queries, and discussion. And I'd like to let that go as long as you're interested, because there are so many issues and themes here to be addressed, and Ibrahim has such a wide-ranging understanding of these matters that it's a singular opportunity. But we will break for a moment at, if you wish, at 8:30, quarter to 9, for those of you that need to leave. You're welcome to do that. So, thank you.
Thank you for coming. Good evening, and good evening. I hope that you're doing well tonight. We have to drive from Edmonton to here to be with you, so I'm delighted to be back here. I was here 2 months ago or so. I'm going to explain some of what you see here on the board before I could talk about some substantial stuff in relation to what we call political Islam. It's much more than political Islam, but I'll talk about that in a bit. And I'm going to begin with the 19th century in the Muslim world. Of course, those of you who are familiar with the 19th century in Europe, Europe had major changes also in the 19th century. And that was very true in the context of the different Muslim countries in the 19th century. And that's why in the 19th century, within the Muslim world, all the way from Morocco to Indonesia, one can identify four major responses to what we call the relationship between Islam and the West. And the first major response we call in history pan-Islam or pan-Islamism. I'm going to explain all of that in detail in the course of my presentation. And the second major Islamic response, these are indigenous Islamic responses. The second major Islamic response had been what I would call text and community, which is the same as Islamic Sufism or Islamic mysticism, where the mystics were concerned only about the sacred text, about the Quran, and not about politics. And the third major response within the Muslim world had been nationalism. Of course, nationalism was introduced perhaps by European powers to different Muslim countries in the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. And the fourth major response have been westernization. You could call it liberalism, westernization, modernization, because these were broad responses that still live with us in the Muslim world nowadays. And these are the four major responses that I am aware of. Of course, everyone has its own subdivisions that we will talk about in a major way today. Let's leave Egypt for a second. When we speak about the Islamic movement or Islamism or political Islam, I think that in terms of families, we can identify three different families or classifications of what we call political Islam. The first one is pre-colonial. That's to say it began roughly in the 17th century, in the 18th century. Although in the Muslim world, pre-colonialism dates to the 16th century. If we take into account that the Dutch occupied Indonesia at the end of the 16th century. But here I'm beginning with the 17th or the 18th century, the pre-colonial. And the second major family of Islamic, political Islam, was born in the context of colonialism. And, sorry, this is my telephone. Usually I don't do that. So, pardon me.
It's pretty though.
Sorry for this. So the second major family of Islamic revivalism or Islamism, let's use the term Islamism, not political Islam, was born in the colonial era, roughly in the 19th century and the 20th century, until independence in the Muslim world. And the post-colonial was born from the 1960s on. Now, one major example of the pre-colonial movement or movements in the Muslim world that are still with us today, the major example is the Wahhabiyya of Saudi Arabia. It was born in the 18th century, by a man called Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who died in 1792, at the end of the 18th century. And this movement is called sometimes, in Arabic and English, Salafiyya, or Wahhabiyya. It's famous for both terms. In South Asia, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Kashmir, and Afghanistan, it's called Ahlul Hadith. That's to say, the people of Hadith. You know, when we come to Islamic sources of knowledge, we usually make a distinction between the Quran as revealed scripture and the Hadith as the sayings of the Prophet of Islam. I don't know whether you've taken a class in Islam here or not. So Hadith refers to the sayings of the Prophet of Islam, Hadith. And those sayings were collected, like 100,000 sayings or so. They were collected by Muslim authorities roughly a century after the death of the Prophet of Islam. The Prophet died in the year 632 AD. That's to say that they were collected in the 8th century of the Christian era, 100 years. And some of these sayings had been invented by certain authorities because of the fluctuating political environment in the Muslim world at the time. And I want to give you one invented hadith or saying of the Prophet, where the Prophet says about the Turks, Utrukul atraka walau tarakukum, leave the Turks as long as they leave you alone. If they love you, they will steal from you. If they hate you, they will kill you. Now, this is not an authentic hadith. Why? Because the Turks were brought to the Muslim country, to Baghdad, the capital of the Abbasids, 250 years after the death of the Prophet. So the Prophet could not have seen or met Turks during his lifetime. So that was invented because the Turks were brought as part of the army of the Abbasids, and they used to drink and rape and all of that, and that's why Muslim authorities invented that hadith against the Turks. And the Turks, of course, invented lots of hadith against the Arabs.
that the Arabs are barbarian and this and that, you know, we have lots. So that's, but of course, we have what we call authentic hadith. That's to say that Muslim authorities would say that, you know, this hadith is narrated by, let's say, my father, who had heard that from his father all the way to the Prophet of Islam. We have a chain of authority. And the Wahhabiyya focused on the revival of hadith in the 18th century. Because the Wahhabiyya was saying that the two major sources of Islam are the Quran, the words of God on the one hand, and the hadith, the sayings of Muhammad, who is not a god but a human being, on the other hand. So the hadith is very much elevated as a second primary source within Islam after the Quran. Now there are some Muslims, including Sunni Muslims, who don't believe in hadith, who would say that all of the hadith was invented. And that's why we cannot talk about authentic hadith or weak hadith, because every hadith is weak by definition, since it was established a century after the death of the Prophet. And also, they say, we don't need a hadith because we have the Quran. That's the primary word of God. And that's the difference perhaps between Wahhabiyya and other sects within Islam, that Wahhabiyya has promoted the study of the hadith in a major way. And that's why in India and South Asia, they are called Ahl al-Hadith, the people of hadith. And you may have heard, you know, Taliban, I will talk about Taliban later, Taliban is a Wahhabi movement. But they never used the term Wahhabi, because that term was given to them by the British, to the Wahhabis of Arabia, by the British in Iraq and in the Gulf in the 19th century. The British had an influence on what we call Kuwait nowadays, and in southern Iraq in the 19th century. Kuwait and southern Iraq were part of the Ottoman world until roughly 1917.
Abraham, can you please close that? I can smell the
this
ink?
Yes.
This?
Oh, if you don't mind, thank you. It,
no,
it gives me a headache. Sorry, thank you.
That's fine. I thought you wanted me to shut up, so you could go home. Yeah, okay. So that's the Wahhabiyya. Therefore, the Wahhabis of Arabia don't use the term Wahhabiyya, because that's a pejorative term. It's a term that was given to them by the British in Kuwait in the 19th century. Because Wahhabiyya is similar to or akin to the term Muhammadans. That's to say, those who belong to Muhammad. And that, this is not acceptable from an Islamic perspective. Because Muslims are not Muhammadans, they are Muslims. That's to say that they are submissive to God and not to Muhammad. Muhammad was just a messenger or the prophet of God. In the same vein, Wahhabiyya means that they belong to Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the founder, but he did not call himself Wahhabi. It's like Karl Marx never called himself a Marxist. It was Lenin and Trotsky and whatever, Isaac Deutscher, who called them Marxists later on after the death of Karl Marx. The Wahhabiyya called themselves, sorry that I need to open this. The Wahhabiyya called themselves Salafis. So we have another term, Salafiyya. And Salafiyya means following in the footsteps of the ancestors. That's to say, of the Prophet and the companions. That's to say, traditionalists in English. It's like, you know, in the Christian tradition, you go back to tradition, to the days of the church fathers and all of that. This is the same as Salafi in Christianity. You know, so if you are a Christian Salafi, it means that you always have to go back to the past to revisit your own identity and your own history and origins. That's Salafiyya. And therefore, Muhammad Abdul Wahhab said that we, Muslims of Arabia of the 18th century, we are Salafi people because we go back to the origins of Islam. But above all, he said, we are the only authentic Salafis. Because there's another famous hadith of the Prophet of Islam. Well, the Prophet says, and this hadith is authentic according to the books of hadith, where the Prophet says that my community, my ummah, the Muslim ummah, at the end of days is going to divide into 73 different communities or groups. like the Muslim communities in Edmonton. We have perhaps 100 Muslim communities. And only one of them is going to be saved. And this saved community is the Salafi community, those who follow the Salaf. And that's why the Wahhabis or the Salafis of Arabia of the 18th century and since the 18th century have used that term Salafi to mean that they are following in the footsteps of the ancestors, but above all, they are the only true and authentic Muslim community out of the multitude of communities. And that's a huge difference. And that's why the Salafis, since the 18th century, have attacked Shiism in its different manifestations as inauthentic. So the Shiites, all of the Shiites, the Ismailis, the Druze, whatever, are not authentic Muslims at all. On the contrary, they are much worse than the kuffar, the infidels. Why? Because as you well know, in the Quranic text, Jews and Christians are considered to be people of a sacred text, Ahlul Kitab. They possess a sacred text. So Jews and Christians, from a Quranic perspective, are not infidels. They are people of faith. Their faith is different from the Islamic faith. They possess a sacred revelation that is acceptable by Islam and by the Quran. Whereas the Shiites to the Wahhabis or the Salafis of Arabia are infidels. They are kuffar. So which means that they have a lower status than Jews and Christians in the Islamic, in the Wahhabi Salafi context. Okay. So this Wahhabiya movement has been there for the past 220 years to say the least. And we'll talk more about that. But it had been, in its origin, a theological movement that came to revive Islam and Islamic practices and Islamic ideas, and it came to apply the tradition and the behavior of the Salaf, of the ancestors, in a modern setting, the 18th century. Okay? But since the beginning of the 19th century, there has been a wedding, an intermarriage between the Wahhabiya movement as a theological movement and the Saudi tribe, the tribe of Al Saud. And that wedding has been there since roughly 1810 until the present time. That's to say that it is impossible for us to understand the political or religious identity of Saudi Arabia since the 19th century without understanding the wedding between theology and state, between theology and politics, in the heart of Saudi Arabia. And that's why when we say that the Wahhabis are extremists, you know, we have to understand that, you know, the historical context of that I'm going to talk about in the course of my presentation. So Wahhabiya is therefore the most prominent pre-colonial Islamic movement that is still existing with us today. And it has had different manifestations in the Muslim world, especially in South Asia, and especially also in the thinking and the theology of Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda was established by Osama bin Laden, who came squarely from Wahhabiyya. Osama bin Laden never abrogated Wahhabiyya in his life. Until now, if he's still alive, he is still a Wahhabi thinker. He of course attacked the Saudi family that had been in control of Islamic theology. But he never attacks in his own speeches Wahhabiyya. And that's a distinction that we have to bear in mind, because that's very significant for the understanding of the origins of Al-Qaeda and how come that Al-Qaeda has become a global movement. It's because of Wahhabiyya, not because of violence. Of course, violence becomes a second stage in the evolution of the Qaeda that we'll talk about as well. Now, one second major Islamic movement that had been there since the 17th century or the 18th is what we call the Dan Fodio Islamic movement of Northwest Nigeria. It was a revivalist Sufi movement. Dan Fodio was a Sufi person who studied Sufism in present-day Algeria, who went to Nigeria and who wanted to revive Islamic practices and Islamic ideas in Nigeria at the time. Nigeria has a large Muslim population. You know, I don't know the statistics, but at least 50% of the population is Muslim, and most of the Muslims live in the northern part of Nigeria. So that's another major movement. And we have still a sultanate in Nigeria, or a caliphate in the name of the Dan Fodio movement. But this movement did not become a universal one for all sorts of reasons. Basically, it's limited to Africa, and specifically to Nigeria. Now, in the second category or family of Islamic movements that are born roughly in the middle part of the 19th century and on, in that century, in the 19th century until the first half of the 20th century, we have lots of Islamic movements that are still with us today. And the most famous one is the Muslim Brotherhood Movement of Egypt that was active in the demonstrations in Cairo until a few days ago. I think that in addition to the youth who were demonstrating in Cairo, the Muslim Brotherhood movement was the most organized and aggressive movement in the demonstrations against the regime of Hosni Mubarak. And this was established, as I may have said, in 1928 by a man called Hassan Banna, B-A-N-N-A, Hassan Banna. Who was killed, who was murdered in 1949 by the Egyptian secret police in 1949. And later on, the person who came to raise the mantle of the Muslim Brotherhood movement is the famous person Sayyid Qutb. Sayyid Qutb, who became famous in the West after the 9/11 attacks on the USA. And I wrote my first major book on him back in 15 years ago or so. It's published by SUNY, State University of New York Press, under the title of Intellectual Origins of Islamic Resurgence in the Modern Arab World, Sayyid Qutb. He becomes the major ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood movement 2 or 3 years after the assassination of Banna, roughly in 1951. He himself gets executed by Nasser, by the Nasser regime, in 1964. And he is considered to be a martyr of the Islamic movement in the Arab and the Muslim worlds. We'll talk more about him in a second. So the Muslim Brotherhood movement, therefore, is one major Islamic movement that arises in the age of colonialism when the British were colonizing Egypt in 1928. And the Muslim Brotherhood movement throughout the years becomes an Arab movement. So let's say in the Sudan in the 1940s, because of proximity between the Sudan and Egypt, the Sudan establishes its own branch of the Muslim Brotherhood movement in 1942. And that branch was established by students, Sudanese students who had studied in Cairo, especially who had listened to Sheikh Hassan al-Banna preach about the revival of Islam and Islamism and the Islamic movement. And the leader of the Islamic movement in the Sudan nowadays is by the name of Hassan Turabi. And I happen to know him pretty well. He invited me to the Sudan 15 years ago when he was almost the vice president of the country. He was dethroned like 5-6 years ago, but he is still an influential player in Sudanese politics and in Sudanese religion, the religion especially Islam. So that's the Muslim Brotherhood movement. We see branches for that movement all over the Arab world. Indonesia is not called the Muslim Brotherhood, it's called the Renaissance Party. And its leader just came back to Tunisia 2 weeks ago. His name is Sheikh Ghannouchi, Rashid Ghannouchi, who used to live in exile in London for at least 22 years. He came back to Tunisia after 22 years of absence. And he's the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood movement that is called the Renaissance Party in Tunisia. He's a fascinating thinker. I had a chance to write about him in one of my books and interview him at length in London like 7-8 years ago. He has a degree in philosophy from the University of Damascus in Syria. And he's fluent in several languages and a very fine speaker. So that's about the Muslim Brotherhood movement. The second major mass Islamic movement in the world today is a movement that was established in British India in 1941 that we call Jamaat al-Islami. Jamaat al-Islami is an Arabic term that is used in Urdu which means the community of the Muslims, or the Muslim community. This movement was established by a man called Maududi, who died in 1979. Allama Maududi, Allama means scholar Maududi, was born in British India. He received a traditional Islamic education. He was very much upset with British colonialism over India. He wrote so much against that. He wrote against imperialism and this and that. And later on, we'll talk more about this, but I just want to clarify this point, that the birth of the movement was in direct response to British presence and colonialism in India. That's my point at this stage. I'm going to elaborate on all of these points later on. So that's, you know, another major mass movement. Here in North America, the Jamaat al-Islami is called ICNA, Islamic Circle of North America. And there's a branch of ICNA in Edmonton, all over Canada. The Muslim Brotherhood movement in North America, they have a branch that is called MAC, the Muslim Association of Canada, in Canada. In the USA, it has a different name, but they have a major presence in the city of Edmonton too. So their intellectual origins go back to the founders, especially Barna and later on Sayyid Qutb. Now, a third major movement that I did not write down here is called Muhammadiyya. Just bear with me a bit, you know, since you may encounter all of these names in the future. So if your plane is hijacked, you know what to say.
It's quite helpful.
That's an Orientalist thing, but I'm sorry. You know that joke about Pakistani International Airlines, PIA? You know the joke about PIA? It stands for Pakistani International Airlines, but it also stands for Please Inform Allah before you board the plane. So PIA. Air India means Allah informed. Sorry if you are from India. Now they have privatized the industry. So. Now, these two major movements were born in Indonesia in the first half of the 20th century. The first one is called Muhammadiyya, that was born in 1909 in the city of Yogyakarta, where I was a visiting professor for a year in Gajah Mada University. It was established in 1909 in response to Dutch colonialism. I'm sorry if some of you are from a Dutch background, you know. They colonized Alberta after Holland, after Indonesia. And the second major movement was born in the Indonesian countryside in 1926. It's called Nahdlatul Ulama, which means, it's an Arabic name, which means the renaissance of Muslim scholars and scholarship. Now, Muhammadiyya was an urban Islamic movement that aimed at teaching Islamic studies, Arabic language, from first grade all the way to the university. So in Indonesia, in present-day Indonesia, we have 20 different universities in 20 different cities of the country that are called Muhammadiyya University or universities, and they have the same objective or aim, which is to teach Islamic studies in a country that is not Arab, but it is where the majority of Muslim, it's a majority Muslim country. It's an urban movement. It's a movement that brought Ottoman Islam, and I will talk about that, pan-Islam of Ottomanism to Indonesia from Hijaz, from Arabia. Because the founder of Muhammadiyya had lived in Medina and Mecca for 7 years. He learned Arabic. Mecca and Medina had been under the authority of the Ottomans all the way until the end of 1917, until November of 1917, when the Ottoman army was defeated by T.A. Lawrence and the British and all of that, the French in the Middle East. So the Muhammadiyya transmitted Ottoman Islamic ideas of Islamic reform or pan-Islam to Indonesia. which is not an Arab territory, it's very far from the Middle East, and they began to instruct their students in the context of pan-Islam and Ottoman Islam and what we call Arabic Islam, especially from Hijaz, from Western Arabia. Now, by the way, Mecca and Medina, this area, Hijaz, was conquered by the Saudi kingdom only in 1928. So, you know, if you know a bit of history, the Ottomans conquered the whole Middle East and North Africa and Hijaz, Western Arabia, in 1517. And I'll talk about that in the context of talking about Egypt in a second. But anyway, so these are also two primary examples in Southeast Asia of Islamic movements born in the context of colonialism. In this case, Dutch colonialism. Now, let's talk about the third category or third family of Islamic movements, because that comes from a different genre, different family, and different historical circumstances. It's the post-colonial, post-independence Islamic movements. And these are the movements that have become, at least in the West, much more significant and much more urgent for us to understand and much more violent than the most established movements, especially in the second category. We in the West do not talk much about the Muslim Brotherhood movement. I mean, we did in the past 2-3 weeks because of Al Jazeera in English, but in the past we did not talk much about the Muslim Brothers or Jamaat al-Islami. We never talk about Muhammadiyah, although it has 40 million members in Indonesia. Nahdlatul Ulama has almost 60 million members in Indonesia. We never talk about these mass-oriented movements in the largest Muslim country in the world. And they are much more significant to my mind than the smaller movements that are called Jihad or Taliban or Qaeda or whatever that were born 20 years ago or so. So these movements were born in the past 20, maximum 30 years. And let me give you some specific examples. Egyptian Jihad. Egyptian Jihad was born in 1979, a year or so after the signing of the Camp David peace accords between Israel and Egypt. And Egyptian Jihad is the movement that assassinated Anwar Sadat on October 18, 1981. So he was assassinated for betraying Islamic tradition and signing a covenant or an agreement with the enemies of Islam, according to Jihad, the Jews, okay? According to the Jihad organization. So the Jihad organization has had many leaders, but one prominent leader who is now in Afghanistan, or, I mean, no one knows where he is now. Even the CIA does not know where he is. His name is Ayman Zawahiri. Ayman Zawahiri. He is the second in command of the Qaeda after Bin Laden. And I believe that Bin Laden has been dead since October 2001. And I believe that Zawahiri is the first in command. And there is a major book published in London, The Road to Al-Qaeda, which is a biography of Ayman Zawahiri. And I wrote the introduction to that book. It came out 5 or 6 years ago. It's published by Pluto Press in London. And basically, Ayman Zawahiri comes from a well-established and well-educated family. He's a physician by profession. And he escaped Egypt in 1982 at the height of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He went to Peshawar, Pakistan. He fought against the Soviets. And later on, he established Al-Qaeda with Bin Laden. So the biography that I talked with you about, The Road to Al-Qaeda, speaks about the alliance, the political, ideological, and religious alliance between Bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri in forming Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda means the base in Arabic, the base, Al-Qaeda. That's to say, an Islamic base for major operations. Now, Taliban as a movement was not born or given birth to by Al-Qaeda or Jihad, because Taliban had been given birth to by Wahhabiyya, by Ahlul Hadith in South Asia. So Taliban is another movement of Ahlul Hadith. And Taliban in Pashtun is taken from the Arabic root Talaba. It means theological students or students of theology. That's what Taliban means. So we have had Taliban for centuries. And we would have Taliban for many centuries to come, even if the Taliban community, the military community of Taliban, is destroyed by NATO, we will still have Taliban. Because that means madrasas, Islamic theology, Islamic seminaries, they will not close down like Taylor Seminary in Edmonton because they will never run out of money. They have lots of hashish to sell to the world. So perhaps that's a good idea for Taylor University, you know, to sell hashish in the, on 118th Avenue just to survive. So anyway, Taliban is a, you know, is a seminary for Muslim students who study the Quran and Islamic sciences in a Wahhabi way, in a Salafi way, in a rough way, that we are the only authentic Muslims in the world. The Shias are kuffar, the Jews and the Christians are kuffar, and that's why it's lawful for us to kill Shias, Jews, and Christians, because we are the only authentic community within Islam. Okay? But the Taliban, therefore, you know, could not be a post-colonial movement because it has been there in South Asia for centuries. But it is a new Islamic movement in a sense that it was born in the context of the Soviet conquest of Afghanistan in response to the Soviet invasion and the massive killing of the Afghani people, women and men, by the Soviets since their occupation of the of Afghanistan beginning December 25th, 1979 until their expulsion from Afghanistan in 1989. So for 10 years or so, the Taliban and other movements have been significant jihadi movements against the foreign enemy. And later on, the Taliban had, you know, was able to establish a state with the blessings of three major countries: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. So that's why the Taliban is a new Islamic movement in that sense. But in the sense of theology, it's not a new movement at all. In the sense of theology, it's a very ancient movement in South Asia, in this case in Afghanistan. Another major Islamic movement that was born in the past 20 years or so is the Palestinian Hamas. Hamas. And Hamas is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood movement, but it was in effect born in Gaza, in occupied Gaza, in 1987. And Hamas was the movement to start the first intifada, the first uprising against the Israeli occupation on the West Bank and in Gaza in 1987. It is a significant movement in Palestinian politics because it controls Gaza nowadays. And if there were free elections on the West Bank and Gaza, most probably Hamas would be able to control the West Bank as well, because it has resisted any compromise with Israel and the occupation forces in Israel and so on. So, you know the story. It's a long story. A few years back, I was in Singapore giving a talk on interfaith dialogue, and I happened to share the dinner table with the Prime Minister of Singapore, the young man, and I chatted with him, and I said, because, you know, the Singaporean army is being trained by the Israeli army, so the Israelis are very big in Singapore, plus the Israeli Mossad and all of that. I said, so we talked about Hamas and all of that. I said, you know, the problem with your friends, the Israelis, is that they love hummus, whereas they hate Hamas. That's very true. I mean, they have to begin to, you know, to love hummus at least as a step towards liking Hamas too in the future, because they make better hummus than Yemeni Jews and Tel Aviv. Another major movement that was born in the past 20 years is the Lebanese Hezbollah, which is headed by Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah. Hezbollah was born in 1996. It's a brand new organization. Perhaps, you know, Hezbollah is a very powerful organization. You know, the other day I was doing some shopping in a superstore, and I met a man who looked like he was Lebanese, but he was born here. And he was a Maronite Lebanese. So he asked me where I was from. I said, you know, I was born in Palestine. He said, oh, you Palestinians are fighting, you know, Hamas and the PLO and this and that. I said, yeah, but that's much better than Hezbollah controlling the state in Lebanon. Because Hezbollah is the state. You know, the Lebanese army does not have enough power. Hezbollah is the state in Lebanon now, and it has been roughly since the year 1996. And that's why 4 years ago, Israel tried to destroy Hezbollah, the military bases of Hezbollah, although Israel unleashed so much destruction against the civilians in Lebanon and lots of neighborhoods in Beirut and this and that and bridges, they failed to destroy Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is stronger than ever in Lebanon nowadays. I'm going to Lebanon 2 days from now. Hopefully I will not be arrested by them. I have to be nice when I talk about Hezbollah in Lebanon, not here. So these are basically, you know, we have lots of other organizations in Pakistan, in Kashmir, in Indonesia, in Malaysia that were born in the past 20 years or so. Lots of them, you know, Shabab Muhammad, this and that. These organizations are very significant in the scene, basically because these organizations believe that the mass-oriented organizations, the Muslim Brotherhood movement, the Jamaat Islam, Muhammadiyah, have been bought by the game of democracy, of elections. And basically they say that our solution to the Muslim predicament nowadays is not through democracy and democratic elections. It is only through jihad or violence. That's the only solution. And that's what distinguishes also these movements from the mass-oriented movement. Of course, there's a historical difference, but there's also a difference in the emphasis upon Islamic faith and ideology. Because these people elevate the concept of jihad. Jihad is part and parcel of the Quran, of the Quranic text. Jihad is mentioned so many times in the Quran, hundreds of times. So no one can ignore that. You know, you cannot say that jihad is just, you know, sorry, kissing your enemy. You know, jihad is jihad. Jihad has its own rules in Islamic Sharia or Islamic jurisprudence. And Muslim jurists have talked about jihad in an extensive way. So we cannot ignore the military dimension of jihad throughout the Islamic centuries. And these people have invented or reinvented the military dimension of jihad by saying that we have known international enemies headed by the USA and Israel. Their aim has been to rob the Muslims of their resources, to occupy the Muslim world, to exploit their resources, and that's why we have to use jihad. We have to use Muslim power in order to defend ourselves against the Western usurpers and occupiers. That's basically the philosophy of these movements throughout the Muslim world. Whereas, you know, with the Muslim Brothers or Jamaat Islami, they are very pragmatic in an American way. So you never know what they are talking about. like the Americans, you know, they are very good at that. Any questions so far before I proceed?
And that last point.
Questions? Yes, please.
Did the Al-Qaeda name come from the Bin Laden family that used to build all the bases and so on over there? And maybe still does. Yeah, the base. It was called base or something like that.
No. I mean, it's called the Bin Laden family construction business.
Right.
Even they had some business dealings with Bush, you know, before he became president.
Right.
And after he became president, too. No, Al-Qaeda was a name given to it by Osama bin Laden and the Arab Mujahideen in Afghanistan who were fighting against the Soviets. Al-Qaeda means that we have a base in Afghanistan because they thought that Afghanistan would be the first authentic Islamic base from which Muslim forces or Muslim jihadists would launch their activities against the rest of the world, against the Indians in Kashmir, even against Pakistan, against Iran. Iran is a Shiite country. You know, Iran was extremely delighted when the Taliban fell. And the Americans did that to Iran as a major favor. And the same with Saddam Hussein. So the Americans did two major favors in less than 3 years to the Iranians. And the Iranians have become a major power in the area after the weakening of Pakistan. It's the Iranians. And that's why the U.S. has been very hesitant to attack Iran because of its major influence upon Afghanistan as well as upon the Iraqi government nowadays. Now, although the Taliban hated Iran because of Shiism, the Iranians are arming the Taliban nowadays. how come that the Taliban are able to resist the NATO for such a long time? Where do they bring the arms from or the money from? It comes primarily from Iran. So Iran is supporting the Taliban in a major way because the Taliban now is in a different position than it was 10 years ago. Any other question before
I perceive. Yes? No? No question from Dubai? Okay. Now, let's go to this one. I'm coming back to this in a second. The Ottoman Caliphate, the Ottomans ruled in the name of Islam for at least 500 years. The Ottomans conquered the, what we call the Middle East in 1516-1517. The Middle East here is defined as, first of all, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Transjordan, Iraq, Kuwait, Western Arabia, what we call Hejaz, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. That was the, in addition to the Balkans, Eastern Europe. That was the Ottoman world. But the Ottomans ruled in the name of Islam. How come that was the case? That when they conquered Egypt in 1517, they brought some of the Muslim caliphs who had been hiding in Cairo for centuries to Istanbul. And those caliphs gave them the mantle of the Prophet and the sword of the Prophet, which was a sign that the Ottomans are ruling in the name of Islam. That was in 1517. And that's why initially the Ottomans called themselves Ottoman Khilafah, Caliphate, or the abode of Islamic Caliphate. Caliphate is an Islamic political term, means a successor or succession to the Prophet of Islam. That's to say that the first man to rule after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD was a person by the name of Abu Bakr. He was the first Khalifa or Caliph, which means that he succeeded Muhammad in his political and social mission, but not in his prophetic mission. Because Muhammad was the prophet, he was the final prophet, and the only prophet, the final, not the only prophet, but the final prophet, the seal of prophets. And Abu Bakr or any caliph after him could not have become a prophet, but any person who ruled in the name of prophecy, in the name of the political dimension or role of the Prophet of Islam. And that's why caliphate becomes an institution, especially in Sunni Islam. It becomes a major institution. An institution with scholars, with lots of funding and all of that. And therefore the masses' responsibility would be to defend the caliphate, not only as an Ottoman caliphate or Abbasid caliphate or Arab caliphate, but as an Islamic caliphate. That's to say that it is a caliphate given by God and the Prophet of God to that particular person in order to expand Islam in the name of the caliphate, in the name of the Prophet, in the name of God. So the Ottomans assumed that caliphate roughly 50 years after the conquest of Constantinople, which was done in 1453, but in 1517, 1518, they become the Ottoman Muslim caliphs. That's to say, ruling in the name of Islam, that's to say that their rule becomes universal, and in that sense, they begin to inaugurate the concept of pan-Islam. The concept of pan-Islam here. So pan-Islam as a concept is not a 19th century product. I believe it is a 17th or 16th century product, but in the 19th century it takes a different manifestation, a unique position, because of the Western threat to the integrity of the Ottoman Caliphate, because the Ottoman Caliphate was called by Europe the sick man of Europe in the 19th century. And basically the Europeans did not know how to divide the spoils except after the end of the war, of the First Great War, by 1918, the end of 1917. So that witnessed the failure of pan-Islam by the end of the First Great War. Now the caliphate, you know, I was listening to a lecture by a well-known Turkish professor in Singapore many years ago, when he was speaking about the succession of the caliphate. You know, Turkey became a new and modern Turkish Republic in 1924. And this professor said that Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, did not dissolve the Ottoman Caliphate. On the contrary, he gave that authority to the Speaker of the House in the Turkish Parliament. So the Turkish Parliament is the embodiment of the Ottoman Caliphate until the present time, from at least a theoretical perspective. And that's why the current Islamic party in power,
the Justice Party in power, in a sense, is trying to revive that historical model of Ottomanism, and they call it Neo Ottomanism in modern Turkey nowadays. That's to say that, you know, he is ruling in the name not only of Turkish nation, but in the name of the Islamic Ottoman Caliphate, that's to say in the name of universal Islam. And that's why, you know, Turkey has been brilliant in presenting itself as, in the past 5 years or so only, as a major representative of universal Islam, defending the Palestinians, even defending the demonstrators in Egypt against the regime of Mubarak and so on and so forth. So, therefore, with these Ottoman responses, the first major response is an old response, but it takes a different shape. This is the pan-Islamic response. That's to say, it's a response under the threat of European powers. The Ottomans wanted to revive Islamic religion through modernization and through preserving their Ottoman Empire. They did not want to let go of the concept of the Islamic Caliphate. However, they agreed to modernize the Islamic Caliphate. And modernization began with the higher ranks of the army, then the bureaucracy, then the educated people. So the major officers were sent to Germany in the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, to educate themselves. Some educated people were sent to France, not to England or the USA, but to France to study. And that's why they built French schools and hospitals and whatever. And also the Germans had a major interest in the Ottoman world. The Germans, of course, built the Istanbul-Hijaz Railway. It's called Damascus-Hijaz Railway. It began with Istanbul. It began actually in Germany, all the way to Istanbul, Istanbul-Damascus, Damascus-Hijaz, Transjordan, from Transjordan to Mecca and Medina. And there was another line that went from Jordan to Haifa in Palestine, Ottoman Palestine at the time. You know, if you know about the Baha'i religion, when Baha'u'llah was exiled, he followed that route. So he came from Istanbul to Damascus, Transjordan, Haifa, where he resided until he passed away. That's very significant in the history of the Ottoman world. And therefore, the Ottomans wanted to preserve the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic Caliphate. They wanted to preserve Islam as a central religion in addition to Christianity and Judaism within the Ottoman Empire. And they wanted to modernize as a way to withstand Western pressures, European pressures on the Ottoman state at the time. And if you look at the Ottoman Empire, you know, some Turks, or as a matter of fact, many Turks would not like the term empire. They would say it is khilafa, or it is a caliphate, or a sultanate. But I believe that it had been an empire, because any definition of an empire, it is a multi-glot, multi-ethnic, and multi-cultural state. You know, you might say, Canada is an empire too. I don't think so. But the USA is a major empire, in the same way that the Ottomans were a major empire. So that was the major response. That was very precise and very dominant in the Ottoman religious and intellectual discourse in the 19th century and in the first 20 years of the 20th century. And it's a discourse that failed because of the defeat of the Ottoman army in the war and the division of the Ottoman spoils in the Middle East, especially between France and England. And we know that story pretty well. The Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration and all of that, this came out in the wake of the dissolution of the Ottoman state. Now, I just want to mention one major fact, which is very interesting. And I came to know about this fact only when I discovered Burma, which they call Myanmar nowadays, to the east of Bangladesh, west of Thailand, that when the Ottoman army was defeated in Palestine by the British, there were 70,000 Ottoman officers and Ottoman soldiers. And those soldiers and officers were mixed. They were Ottoman, that's to say, they were Turks, Kurds, Arabs, perhaps Bulgarians, whatever. So when that army was defeated, all of these troops became prisoners of war, and they were shipped off by the British all the way to Burma, where they died. The last soldier died in 1964, and we have two major cemeteries outside of Yangon in northern Burma that are called Turkish cemeteries. They are not Turkish, they are Ottoman. Because, you know, perhaps most of the people buried there were Turks, but there were Kurds and Arabs and all sorts of people, Iraqis and Egyptians and Palestinians, who were exiled and who died in exile. The second major response in the Ottoman world in the 19th century, before Kemal Atatürk, because Kemal Atatürk emerged on the scene after the defeat of the Ottoman army, was an Ottoman response by saying that we want to preserve the empire, plus modernization, forget about Islam. Because, you know, Islam had been responsible for our backwardness. We have not caught up with the Western notion progress because of Islam, because of the philosophy of Islam and the vision of Islam. Western philosophy and Western vision are very different from the Islamic ones. So we better preserve the empire and modernize, that's to say, westernize the empire without Islam, minus Islam. The third major option was nation, that's to say, Turkish nation and modernization without Islam. And this is the option that succeeded after the war with the foundation of the modern Turkish Republic of Kemal Atatürk. That's to say, the focus on the Turkish nation. That's to say that any citizen of Turkey must be a Turk, even if you were an Arab or Armenian or Greek or Bulgarian or Kurd, you must be a Turk. Because that's the only part, that's your location is found in Turkey. If you are a Turk, if you are in Turkey, then by definition you are a Turk. And that's why Arabic and Kurdish and other non-Turkish languages were banned by Kemal Atatürk until recently, until like 5 years ago or so. And this whole tradition is called Kemalism. That's to say the tradition of Kemal Atatürk, which focuses on modernization and the Turkish nation. And that's why you can see why the Armenians, let's say, detested that movement, because Turkish nationalism would never acknowledge the massacre of the Armenian people en masse during the war. They would never acknowledge also the oppression of the Kurdish people. You know, Turkey is a country nowadays of 80 million people. At least 15 to 20 million people are Kurds. And until 5 years ago, the Kurds had no rights in Turkey at all because they were Turks. From the standpoint of the definition of the state, they were only allowed to exist as Turks, not as Kurds. In Germany, they were allowed to exist as Kurds, but not in Turkey. Now, the last major response that we see also in the 19th century is the Sufi response, the text and community response that was carried by Sufi brotherhoods and groups and communities that were apolitical in nature, that they don't believe in intervening in the political process. You know, there were a group of people dedicated, pietists, dedicated to the text, and that's why they were left alone in a sense, but it was a major movement. Questions so far? I'm not done yet. Yes? Do you have a question?
I'm sorry, no, I was just saying a lot to take in.
So, shall we finish then?
No. Oh. The 800-word newspaper articles don't quite cover all this.
Now, I'll talk about Sayyid Qutb in a second. But let me do this here of Egypt. You know, Egypt that we call Misr, in Arabic, Mitzrayim in Hebrew, in the Bible Mitzrayim, is a country that was conquered by the Muslim forces 7 years or so after the death of the Prophet of Islam in 639 AD. And since that time, Egypt has remained primarily an Islamic state, with the Coptic Christians becoming a minority within Egypt since that time. And Egypt has also functioned as a major religious center for Islam, in addition to Iraq and Syria. But that religious centrality of Egypt begins to take shape only in the 10th century under the Fatimid Ismaili state. You know about the Ismaili community, I'm sure that some of them live here in Camaros as well. The Ismailis are the same as the Fatimids. The Fatimids established a major empire, a major caliphate that was called Al-Khilaf al-Fatimiyya in Cairo. They were the ones to build Cairo in 969. And they were the ones to build also the famous religious institution, Al-Azhar University. Al-Azhar which is now a Sunni theological institution. Azhar University, they built that also at the end of the 10th century. It was the center of their Ismaili Fatimite propaganda or theology, because the Ismailis believed in the spread of their propaganda as a way of converting a large number of Muslims to Ismailism and as a way of controlling the world in the name of Ismaili Islam. And they called themselves Fatimites. So they were a major empire for 200 years until they were abolished by the famous Muslim, Sunni Muslim ruler and fighter Salah ad-Din during the Crusades in 1174. He's the one who conquered, reconquered Jerusalem from the Crusades in 1192. And so, therefore, the Fatimid Empire came to an end by roughly the end of the 12th century. You know, you hear so much about the Druze religion, the Druze in Lebanon nowadays, in northern Israel, as well as in Syria. And we have in Edmonton the Canadian Druze Association. The Druze religion was born in the Fatimid state, roughly in 1020, at the beginning of the 11th century. The Druze is a name that comes from one of the prime ministers of the Fatimid. His name was Druze. So Druze, they belong to that man, who deified, gave divinity to the Fatimid ruler. His name was Al-Mu'taz Billah, who was very famous, built old Cairo. So he deified the Druze leader. He considered him to be a god. And the concept of deification was a very ancient Sassanid pre-Islamic Iranian concept. It was a Zoroastrian concept that was transported by the Druze. And because the ruler did not believe that he was a god, since he passed away when he was only 26 years old, these Druze were persecuted by the next ruler, by his son, and hence they escaped to the mountains of Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria in the 11th century. And that's the history of the Druze religion. Now, in Druze religion, there is a distinction that is made between, especially men, because men carry the mantra of that religion, between those who have a reason and those who don't have a reason. And to them, you know, you have a reason only after you are 40 years old. So if you are 39 and a half, you are still living in the days of ignorance, or jahiliyyah, as we say in Islam. You are still without a reason. According to Druze, you know, so there's a major dichotomy in their theology between those who have reason and those who lack reason. You know, I'm sure that David does not deal with you in such a way, because he's not a Druze yet. So therefore, in the Fatimid state, we see lots of scissions, schisms within the Fatimid state, and we see the influence of what we call Gnosticism, especially Persian Gnosticism, on the Fatimids. And that's why the Fatimids and the Ismailis are not considered to be Muslims by the Sunnites, because in a sense they have deviated from the path of Islam. And nowadays they are ruled, or their major governing body is headed by the Al-Khan, who came to the University of Alberta last year. The difference between the Fatimids are Shiites, but the difference between the Ismaili Fatimids and the Shiites of Iran is this, is that the Shiites of Iran believe in 12 Imams. The last Imam is called the Mahdi. The Mahdi is the Messiah. They are still waiting for the Messiah. He hasn't come yet, and that's why Iranians and Jews are very close to each other. You know, that's why Israel never attacked Iran, because they are still waiting for the Messiah to come. Whereas the Fatimids believe in only 6 Imams, or 7 Imams. The son of Ismail was a young man. And that's why they are called seveners, whereas the ones in Iran, they are called 12ers, who believe in 12 Imams. But the second major distinction is that the Fatimids do not believe in the hidden Messiah, because their Messiah is apparent. He's the Al-Khan. He goes to Harvard. He pays $50,000 as tuition. He enjoys being married to British and French women and all of that. You know, that's the Al-Khan. That's the real one, who claims to descend from the family of the Prophet. Okay. No comments.
You didn't have to.
Now, in the 13th century until the 16th, the beginning of the 16th, we have the Mamluks ruling over Egypt. The Mamluks means military slaves or soldier slaves. There were white slaves who were brought from Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. So most probably there were Christian slaves who were converted to Islam and who would come to defend the frontiers of Islam in Egypt or North Africa and all of that. They were not black slaves. And they are called the Mamluks. Mamluks means the enslaved or the slaves of Islam who became a real power for 300 years in Egypt, for 300 years in India too, before the Mughal Empire. We had a Mamluk state in Delhi. Delhi was established by the Mamluks. Then the Ottomans take over in 1517 in Egypt and the Middle East and North Africa. And we have 400 years of Ottoman history in the Middle East. So we can talk about Ottoman Palestine in the 16th century, 17th, 18th, 19th, until 1917. We can talk about Ottoman Iraq, all of these centuries, Ottoman Egypt, Ottoman Algeria, Ottoman Syria, Ottoman Lebanon. 400 years of history. You know, it's a tremendous amount of history in the Middle East, which means that when the Ottomans began to modernize at the end of the 19th century, because of their weakening empire, that modernization affected Egypt, it affected Palestine, it affected Syria. The American University in Cairo was established in the 19th century because of the Ottomans. The American University in Beirut was established in the 19th century because the Ottomans allowed missionaries to establish religious institutions and educational institutions in the Ottoman territories to modernize, because that was their major aim. They wanted to preserve the empire at all expense, at all cost. Now, in 1805, the Ottomans sent to Egypt an Albanian Ottoman officer. Albania had been under the domination of the Ottomans. An Albanian Ottoman officer by the name of Muhammad Ali, not Muhammad Ali Clay from Kentucky, the USA, the boxer. But, you know, he took his name because of Muhammad Ali, the Egyptian ruler, who seceded because of the weakness of the Ottoman state. He seceded and he established a modernized Egyptian state in 1805. And not only that, he occupied the Sudan. So Sudan and Egypt became one country. And he occupied all of Syria. So for 50 years or so, he occupied Syria. And then he occupied Western Arabia, Hejaz, and he occupied Iraq. And one of his sons was responsible for the opening of the Suez Canal in 1860. And because his son was not able to pay the debts, because he borrowed so much from British banks, the British occupied Egypt in 1882. But they left the monarchy standing. It was the Muhammad Ali dynasty. And the last king in that monarchy, King Farouk, was deposed by Nasser in 1952. King Farouk. Mm-hmm. King Farouk was only 43 years old when he was deposed. He initially married the sister of the Shah of Iran. The Shah was still a young man, Muhammad Ali Pahlavi. And the Shah also married his sister. They exchanged. That was his first wife, but these guys had enough money to marry more than five times, you know, beyond the limit of Islamic law. So King Farouk was deposed. He was exiled to Italy, but he was killed like 11 months after he went to Italy in 1953 by secret Egyptian police in Italy. Okay, so Nasser comes to power, 1952 until 1970 when he died, and then Sadat comes to power from 1970 to 1980. When Sadat did not die, but he was assassinated. There's a difference. You know, when you die, you die, but when you are killed, you are forced to die, in a sense. And after Sadat, Mubarak comes to power until last Friday. So you know the history now, at least. You have a clear idea about the history. Questions about this? Yes?
As I've followed Egypt in the news, I've been really interested in some of the connections to Iran, and I was hoping you could talk about some of that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Let me just erase this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. If you look at this board here, in Egypt we can discern or identify three major brands of Islam, institutional Islam, so to speak. The first one is official Islam. It's represented by the Azhar University, which is a major Sunni institution. I happen to write my PhD dissertation on the history of Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar has nowadays a student population of 400,000 students in Cairo alone. It has 70 different branches in the countryside in Egypt, and it has over 40 different Azhar universities in different parts of the Muslim world, especially in Malaysia and Indonesia. So Al-Azhar is a well-known, established, official Islamic institution. The Sheikh of Al-Azhar lives like a rich person, because he's given a house, a palace by Mubarak, let's say, a $2 million house. And that's why the Sheikh of Al-Azhar would never rebel against the regime. Therefore, the current leader of Al-Azhar never voiced out any criticism against the Mubarak regime, although he knew pretty well. And I met this Azhar Sheikh 2 years ago, before he became the major rector of Al-Azhar. He's a very smart man, he's very pious, he's a Sufi person, but he knew about the corruption of the Mubarak regime and the Mubarak family, but he would never say anything about that corruption. Although, from an Islamic perspective, he should say, he should have said something against the corruption, the prevalent corruption in the Egyptian political elites. So that's the official Islam, part of official Islam, of course. In almost every Arab and Muslim country, we have what we call the Ministry of Islamic Endowments, or Ministry of Islamic Affairs. So the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, that ministry is in control of the 120,000 mosques in Egypt, the hundreds of madrasas and Islamic universities. So we are talking about a wealthy ministry in any Muslim country. Usually in a country like Indonesia, it's the second wealthiest ministry after the Ministry of Defense or the Army. So we're talking about highly wealthy ministries that are in control of the minister, who is usually a graduate of Al-Azhar and very close to the regime. So that's another major branch of official Islam. A third major branch
just a footnote, yes. Ibrahim, about how the Ministry of Endowments is funded and why it's so powerful. That would be useful for them.
It's funded by rent that they receive from especially shops, from bazaars. You know, in Iran there was the bazaar movement. The bazaars would pay rent for the Ministry of Islamic Endowments. And they control lots of land that they can sell sometimes to private institutions, and that's what happened in Egypt. So, you know, these people have access to millions and millions of dollars every day from endowment money. Well, zakah is more private than collective. But yeah, I mean, of course, zakah money too. But zakah goes individually from one family to another family. It does not go through the institution. But it is the whole idea of waqf. Waqf means endowment. So the endowment, you know, the Ministry of Endowment is in control of lots of properties in the country and lots of land. There's also in official Islam one major institution is called the Institution of Ifta. A mufti is a person who issues a fatwa, a religious edict, about all sorts of things. Let's say, you know, you want to get married, you are a Sunni to a Shiite woman or man, whatever. Is that legal from us? So you go to the mufti. So you cannot go to your dad or your mom because you have to have an official edict. So the Dar al-Ifta, the house of Ifta, is also a significant place in Egypt today. And the Mufti Ali Juma supported Sadat all the way until the end. Now, the second major force, religious Islamic force in Egypt, by the way, here under number one, if you look at the Coptic Church also is the official side of the establishment. And as you well know, Baba Shenouda, Pope Shenouda, supported Mubarak until Friday. He could not believe. He said, what are these kids doing to our president? Yeah, he could not believe his eyes. He's 85 years old and all of that. So the Coptic Church officially supported the regime all the way to the end. But lots of Coptic youth, of course, supported the demonstrators. Now, the second major dimension of society is the Salafis in Egypt, the Egyptian Salafis or Wahhabis. They are not Saudis, they are Egyptians, who have fallen under the influence of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab.
and many of whom had studied in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia becomes a major state after the 1940s. In 1951, Saudi Arabia begins to build its own Islamic universities, and they opened the door to all sorts of Muslim youth to come from Nigeria, from Egypt, from Palestine, from Indonesia, all at the expense of the Saudi state, because the Wahhabis have money, because of petroleum. So, therefore, the Salafiyya movement in Egypt was established back in 1922, 6 years before the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. And it is a powerful movement, especially in the city of Alexandria. You know, Alexandria was supposed to be the center of new Platonic philosophy, but that was not the case, because it is the center of the Salafiyya Wahhabiyya movement in Egypt. And that's why when the Coptic Church was bombed last December, you know, people thought it was the Salafis of Alexandria who did it. I never thought that was the case. I think that it was done by the Egyptian Ministry of the Interior just to sow dissent amongst the people, because the Ministry of the Interior knew that its days were numbered. So they just wanted to create dissent between Christians and Muslims in order to be able to maintain the regime for a longer time. But they failed in doing that. But anyway, the Salafi Wahhabis are very strong, and by and large, the Salafi Wahhabis supported the Mubarak regime. They were against the demonstrations of the young people in the Tahrir Square in the middle of Cairo. Why? Because to them, it's against Islamic theology to demonstrate against the ruler. Because the ruler, from the philosophy, from the perspective of Islamic political philosophy, is appointed by God. And you cannot rebel against that divine appointment. And that's why all the major Salafi Wahhabi sheikhs in Egypt preached against the youth and the demonstrations and rebellion, by saying that rebellion is a form of civil discord, what we call fitna in Islam. It's against Islamic spirit to do fitna, disunity in the Muslim community, in the Muslim nation, in the Muslim ummah. So, therefore, the Salafis, who do not like the Azharites, supported the Azharites in supporting the Mubarak regime. And in many ways, the Salafis were given free access to TV and the mass media. They had their own satellite TVs, their own TV stations and all of that, that were supported and perhaps paid for, if not by the government of Egypt, the government of Saudi Arabia. But that was totally different for the Muslim Brotherhood movement. Totally different. Between now and then, every 20 days or so, the Egyptian secret police would go and arrest the leaders of the Ikhwan in Alexandria, in Cairo, in Asyut, in different Egyptian cities. And even, you know, the top leaders of the Ikhwan were arrested like 2 days before the revolt began. And they were freed only on January 25th when the police force were dispersed. Because people came, the masses came to prisons, and they liberated them from prisons. Like they liberated tens of thousands of prisoners, political or non-political prisoners, from Egyptian security forces. So that was amazing that, you know, the Ikhwan decided this time, they had been cautious for at least 40 years, if not more, because they were beaten by Nasser in 1964. Their leader, Sayyid Qutb, was executed by the Nasserite regime. So they were extremely cautious, the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brothers. But this time they understood that this is the end of the regime. They supported the demonstrations, and because of their support, the youth were able to succeed in their revolution against the regime. Now, I believe that in composing a new Egyptian government, the Ikhwan will have a major say in the Egyptian political scene. And the Ikhwan are the brothers of Hamas and Gaza. So the Hamas-Gaza relationship with Egypt is going to substantially change, I believe, in the coming 6 months. And that's what has made Israel very nervous. And the Israeli ambassador and everybody escaped from Cairo. And I don't think that, you know, I believe that Egyptian-Israeli relations are going to substantially change. It will take some time. The Americans will not like it, but the Americans are a weak player nowadays in the Middle East. They are very weak. They did not expect this mass revolt against the Mubarak regime 2 months ago, against the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia. They did not expect that. They thought that Mubarak was firmly in control. But in addition, the Americans have such a bad image in the Muslim world because they have supported dictators. You know, they always say, we want to support democracy, but they just talk about that. You know, it's like, you know, I always say as a Shiite, I want the Messiah to come back, but the Messiah has not come back as of yet. So the Americans have never supported true democracy in the Muslim world. And Muslims know that. I mean, they are not dumb people. So the Muslim Brothers, therefore, are a major force in the Egyptian religious scene, in the Egyptian political scene. The Muslim Brothers have been anti-Salafi and anti-official Islam, anti-Azharite. And because they have been anti-Salafi, they have been hated by the Saudi Arabian kingdom. Now, I want to give you a small note here, a small footnote, which is, you know, Al Jazeera channel, which has become much better and much universally acknowledged than CNN in the world today, in both Arabic and English. There's an English part of Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is led basically by the Muslim Brothers, Egyptian, Palestinian, and Syrian. And the president of Al Jazeera, Wadda Hanfer, is a Palestinian from Gaza. He's a member of Hamas. He's educated in Britain. And that's why Al Jazeera is very much hated, or was very much hated in Egypt until a few days ago. It's very much hated and feared in all of the Gulf states, from Dubai to Kuwait to Saudi Arabia to Oman to Yemen to North Africa. It is not well liked because it is turned by the Muslim Brotherhood movement. It is the international media arm of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. It's amazing. Of course, the one who finances that is the Prince of Qatar. Have you heard of Qatar? Qatar in Arabic means train, the prince of the train. Qatar is a small country. Qatar is a train. Anyway, so, you know, your question about the relationship between this revolt in Egypt and the Khomeini revolution of 1978-79, you know, you know, the Shah had been secular in nature. The Shah of Iran, although there was what we call official Islam, but it was, you know, a small part of the Shah's regime. The Shah was very dumb because he followed the American advice of just, you know, forgetting about religious forces in Iranian society. And he expelled Khomeini from power, from Qom in 1962. But Khomeini came back in 1979 at the head of a victorious revolution against the Shah and the regime. But of course, Khomeini was the symbol of that revolution. There were 100,000 ulama, or scholars of Islam, under the direction and the supervision of Imam Khomeini, when Khomeini was in Iraq, later on in Paris, and they revolted against the Shah. That's to say that it was the ulama who were supposed to be the official supporter of the Shah's regime. Like in the case of the ulama in Egypt, they supported Mubarak. Whereas the Khomeini revolt, or the Khomeini movement, was very similar to the Muslim Brotherhood movement. Of course, there were different branches. One major branch is Mujahidi Khalq. It's a movement that split from Khomeini. It had a camp in Iraq. It was supported by Saddam Hussein. It was invaded a year ago by the current Iraqi government. And now it is supported by the USA because it is anti-Iran and anti the Islamic revolution in Iran. So it's a brief thing about, you know, the religious forces, especially in Egyptian society nowadays. And I believe that the Muslim Brothers are going to have a major say, much more major than the Salafis and the official Islamic establishment in Egypt in the coming few months, especially if they become part of the government, take a part in the new government. Yes?
I was wondering, the relationship between the people and the military. The military were seen as not directly opposing the what was happening in the streets. At the same time, one hears that the military were very closely aligned with,
yes,
and supporting Mubarak. So, in the last couple of days, there's been now a lot of people asking for, I think civil servants and others,
yes,
asking for increases in,
right,
salaries and so on.
Even police officers.
Even the police officers, exactly, were part of it today.
Yeah.
So my question is, and of course, the other thing Mubarak has been saying over and over, look, if I'm not here, the Muslim Brothers are going to take over. So that's been going on as well. So, what do you see is the hope, and do you see the military as being a positive support in this process, you know, in terms of what's going on? And I've also heard 40 million people in Egypt are below the poverty
yes,
line,
right.
And so you've got that dynamic as well. So who all is, do you think is going to be able to move forward, and what is going to prevail as you see it? And obviously I have great hope for safety and goodness to sort of prevail. So what's your hope?
That's a very good question. You know, I have been ambivalent about the Egyptian military for the reason that you have mentioned, is that they have been quiet all of these 30 years about the corruption of the Egyptian regime, and they did nothing. And they did something only with the young people and the Muslim Brothers revolting against the regime. But in addition, we have to learn that since Nasser came to power, Nasser came from the military. Sadat came from the military, Mubarak. So the military has been in charge since 1952. It has not changed. But the question is, you know, the extent of the intervention of the military in civilian life. Now, the Muslim Brothers have been trying to be part of the state since 1952. The Muslim Brothers initially, for the first 2 years of the Nasser regime, supported Nasser, because they thought that Nasser was one of them, because Nasser had been officially a member of the Ikhwan. The Ikhwan is the Arabic term for the Muslim Brothers. So Nasser had been a member of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. But later on, Nasser in 1954 began to speak about nationalism and socialism and all of that. And this was anathema to the Muslim Brotherhood movement, because they expected him to speak about Islamic solidarity, about the Islamic nation, about pan-Islam, not about Arab nationalism. And as you well know, he becomes the hero of Arab nationalism by the end of the 1950s in the entire Arab world. So he Arabized nationalism. He did not Egyptianize nationalism only, he Arabized that. And that's why they tried to assassinate him, the Muslim Brothers, in 1954. But many of them were locked in prison until 1970, basically, after Sadat came to power. So they have now, I think that the Muslim Brothers have a real historic opportunity to build a new society, especially if the army allows them to do that. And you know, you never know whether the Muslim Brothers have infiltrated the army or not, because the Muslim Brothers are a very strong movement in Egypt. They are not a small movement. They are extremely strong in Egypt. Until 1954, there were 1 million members of the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt alone. 1 million members. And many of them are highly educated, highly urbane. They have Western education plus Islamic education. So I believe that they are going to play a major role in Egyptian politics. They will not be the only ones, but they will be a major force in Egyptian society in the coming decade or so. Now let's wait and see. Yes?
I'm intrigued by a comment that I think that you made earlier, that Islam and democracy
yes
do not go together.
That's right.
That
this is the argument of those smaller organizations, Hamas. No, Hamas believes in democracy because they came through democratic means. But Hezbollah, you know, Jihad, Taliban, Qaeda, yes.
Which means, that seems to have I don't
huge
know
how ramifications for the West.
Thank you, Kevin. Yes. Yeah, it's weird. Like the whole preaching of the Bush regime was democratize, as you've always said.
Yeah, but that was only preaching.
Yeah, I understand.
That's right.
Because, see, you know, he said that to the Palestinian Authority, and they went through elections, and Hamas won. Then the U.S. and Israel and Egypt opposed Hamas.
And back in the 50s, Iran had elected a very positive kind of
individual. Iran and the Mossadegh, of course, the same story. The CIA intervened in 1953 against Mossadegh. Any other question or comment?
Yes?
Do you think there's going to be a struggle between the secular side of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood?
There will be an alliance, you said?
I don't know. Struggle.
Struggle.
Because Egypt
has been
secularizing for years.
Yeah. But see, that's right. I mean, the secular forces as compared to the religious forces, but we must remember that a good number of secular forces supported the Mubarak regime. All of these big business people allied with the West and the USA and Switzerland and whatever, they supported the Mubarak regime. Whereas the Muslim Brothers have their own business and they did not support. I think that the Muslim Brothers will run the show to a certain extent. And they know how to deal with the secularist forces in Egyptian society. I don't think that there will be a struggle because the secularists have been defeated. Especially the Mubarak people and his cronies, because all of them were secularists. I mean, they exploited religion. They were not religious people. They have Islamic names, but they were not religious people. Yes?
Dr. Abdurrahi, do I understand it correct? The Muslim Brotherhood promised that they will keep the peace treaty with Israel.
Because they are politicians. That's what Hamas is saying, too. Yes?
What do you believe, Doctor?
I think that the peace treaty with Israel is going to be kept, but it's going to be frozen. It's going to be frozen.
Meaning what, Doctor?
That's to say that Israel, most probably Egypt, is going to stop exporting gas, cheap gas to natural gas to Israel. The Israeli companies will not do business in Egypt. You know, most of the educated Egyptians have boycotted the Israelis and the Israeli embassy. It's only a few people at the top, business people who supported Israel. So it will be a frozen peace with Israel. Now, would the Egyptians abrogate the peace treaty with Israel in the future? It depends on all sorts of reasons. You know, Israel is much less feared nowadays in the Arab world than it was 5 years ago because of Hezbollah. And that's why what's happening in Egypt that might spill out to other Arab countries is somewhat disheartening to Israel. Because Israel claims that it's the only democracy in the Middle East, which is a nonsense, of course. How can you be a democracy and you kill and exploit millions of Palestinians forever? But anyway, they claim to be the only democracy and they don't want any rivalry by other democratic forces in the Arab world. So they prefer dictatorship. Especially a tribal one, run by the same family or by the same ruler for like 30 years or so. Because Egypt had a tribal dictatorship, supported by the army for a long time. Now, you know, I haven't finished, you know, that was the beginning, but I understand.
No, this is the warm up.
We're going to break for 5 minutes, and those of you who need to leave, lovely to see you.
By the way, I have this book, which is 50% discount. It's only $20. Published by the University of Alberta Press on the same issue.
We're coming back. We're coming back. Yeah. We do.
So
we normally have a break.
And then we are allowed to come back.
We normally have a break.
Yeah. Okay, more questions. Yes?
You said that some of the more modern movements in Islam were not democratic in the sense that they didn't see that as important and that they needed to go back to the heart of Islam. Does that also apply to the Muslim Brotherhood? In other words, once elected, they never go away?
Let me, well, they believe in democracy to a certain extent, but let me just say this. As you well know, the whole tradition of democracy in the West is a new tradition. It's like 200 years old, 250 years old. Whereas an Islamic political tradition is like over 1400 years old. So there is a distinct Islamic political tradition that is based on the caliphate, of the Khilafah. So the Muslim Brotherhood movement initially came from the bosom of pan-Islam. Because pan-Islam failed, as I said in my presentation, by the end of the First Great War. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood movement was founded 10 years after the failure or the defeat of the Ottoman army in the war. That's to say that it was established in direct response to the defeat of the Ottoman state and the abolition of the caliphate as an institution, because it was
unified or abolished in the context of the Turkish parliament. So therefore, the Muslim Brothers go back to Islamic political philosophy. Their major political aim is not just to establish an Islamic state over Egypt, but over the entire Muslim world, in theory. They know that they have had severe limitations so far. They have not been able to establish a state in Egypt, but they have been able to establish a state in Sudan. They have been able to establish a state, the same conception in Iran. They have been able to establish a state perhaps in Malaysia. So they know that they can do states, they can establish states. But the primary objective is to establish a pan-Islamic universal state over the Muslim world. That would be in constant dialogue with non-Muslim people, in a sense. But also the Muslim Brotherhood movement is well aware of the European and Western exploitation of the Muslim resources. So they are against that. But they also stand against Western ideas. So in a sense, their philosophy is entirely different from Western philosophy. When it comes to democracy, that's a new tradition in the West itself. Now, the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brothers, are smart enough to realize that the West had preached democracy in the Muslim world, but it has not applied democracy in the same way. And that's why they have not bought the argument of Western democracy. So their major idea is to establish an Islamic state along the political lines of Islamic political philosophy. And they say, yes, okay, you believe in democracy, we believe in democracy to a certain extent. But not your type of democracy, because we have democracy in Islam that we call shura or consultation. So therefore, they Islamize democracy in their own way. And they are right, because you know their own epistemology is very different from Western epistemology. Because Western epistemology, since the Enlightenment, has been highly secularized. Whereas they want to present and preserve Islam in the public sphere. They want Islam to be powerful in society, not only in ministries or universities, but in society itself. And therefore, if you look at Egyptian society since Nasser came to power, I believe that Egyptian society has become more Islamic than before 1952. At the end of the Farouk monarchy, you know, all of these secular forces and feminist Egyptian forces arose in the 1930s and 40s. And I believe that Egyptian society, because of all sorts of things, especially because it has been living in a major crisis, lots of internal crises and lots of external crises, especially the Palestine question, that the Ikhwan, you know, the Ikhwan fought in 1948 against the Zionist settlements in Gaza, in Tel Aviv, and in Jerusalem. So because of those crises, the Muslim Brothers have been, and Muslims by and large in Egypt, have been on the defensive. And when you are on the defensive as a community, you resort perhaps to religion in order to defend yourself and your identity against internal and external enemies. And this is very true with Egyptian society. That's why a large number of these young people, if you, you know, were watching Al Jazeera on Fridays, during the Friday prayers, like the 1 million people in Tahrir Square, perhaps 800,000 or so would pray the Jummah, the congregational prayer together, which is amazing, an amazing sight. This had never happened in the Muslim world except in Iran 30 years ago or so in the 1970s under the Iranian Revolution. But basically, you know, the intellectual Islamic frame of reference is different from the Western frame of reference. We talk about democracy and human rights and all of that, whereas, you know, we in the West oppress other people. It's like we have written our own history, but the history of other people have not been written. And many Muslims, because the Ikhwan are highly educated people, the highly educated community and movement, they know what the West has done in the name of democracy and human rights to Muslims and other human beings.
So Ibrahim, if I can just push that a little bit. On CNN, on MSNBC, on even on the bit that I watched of BBC over the few days of the manifestation, there was a concern about the Muslim Brotherhood and whether what was going to emerge would be a kind of secular democratic state and what have you. And a kind of, I sensed a kind of eagerness to say that the Muslim Brotherhood was really a bit player. Mm-hmm. Egypt has become very secular, and all the young people are really listening to a different drummer. They're Twittering, they're doing all that. They're not religious. I mean, that was a very, very common thing to hear said. Now, those of you that have access to the professorial site for the course, I put on there a YouTube from the Friday prayer, where which is just at the time, I don't know if you've seen it, just at the time that the announcement is made that Mubarak has resigned. So people are praying, and when you look at the square, you know, you say to yourself, are these reporters seeing what I'm seeing? Because, I mean, the square is just wall-to-wall people praying. Mm-hmm. And slowly you hear this kind of titter. Obviously, some people know that Mubarak has resigned. They've yeah. heard the news. But the people continue to pray until that very last moment when they're done. And then it's just this explosion. So are you... Is it the case that, I mean, if you're right about this, that Egypt has become more pious, if in fact the young people are in fact more pious than meets the eye, I mean, just when we were in Syria and in Turkey as well, I mean, I'm surprised at how pious yes. people are. It's surprising. And it's not something
you don't get that on the Western mass.
You just don't get it at all because it's not seen.
Yeah.
But that has that's a tremendously significant part of this.
I think that many of these young people in Cairo do not belong officially to the Muslim Brotherhood movement. Mm-hmm. However, they belong to Islam. Many of them do.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when we have more freedom in Egypt, these young people would have more courage to belong officially to the Muslim Brotherhood movement, because it is the most organized resistance movement in Egypt. And it has sustained itself for the past 50 years, over 50 years, since 1952.
Now, this is not unlike, in my view, you may see this differently, but if we look at Eastern Europe, if we look at Russia, Serbia, Romania, we see something very similar.
Mm-hmm.
That with the immense repression,
yes.
there was this underground movement of piety, and young people took flight to the faith in order to find some kind of identity, some sense of purpose, some sense of who they were as nation.
Now, this is happening in the entire Muslim world, not only in Asia. Not only in the Arab world, but it's happening in Indonesia and Malaysia and Pakistan.
So then it's a question, it seems to me, is who will control the discourse about that?
Yeah.
And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is around second base on this, I suppose, because they've been around, they've been working on this for a long time. What about the changes that have been argued? I mean, a few people that did speak about the Muslim Brotherhood that I listened to and heard suggest that the Muslim Brotherhood from the time of Qutb and Nasser to now, it really is a quite different organization. What's your thoughts about what's usually called the
Muslim Brotherhood is still run by the students of Hassan Banna and Qutb, especially Hassan Banna. The leader is like, he's 79 years old. He's not in Hassan Banna in the 1940s. So this is still run by the same old generation of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. And there has been a split within the Muslim Brotherhood movement like 10 years ago or so of the younger people, just like in Turkey as well. Like Tayyip Erdogan comes from the younger generation of Islamism in Turkey. But still, that doesn't mean that they are revolting against Islam or the Islamic roots of their organizations. I think that's what's going to help the Muslim Brotherhood movement is this, the total corruption of the Egyptian regime, its alliance with Israel and the conservative Arab world and the USA and Europe, and the fact that the USA and Europe did not even raise a voice against them all of these 30 years or so. I think that the US has lost so much credibility in the Arab and the Muslim worlds. Of course, the U.S. has been losing since 9/11 in a major way. But this has been a major loss for the U.S. And the U.S. does not have the money and the finances and the power and the patience to deal with these problems because of their current preoccupation with Iraq and Afghanistan and other parts of the Muslim world. And I think that's why the Muslim Brotherhood movement, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood movement is smart enough. By the way, I know the international spokesman of the Muslim Brotherhood movement. His name is Dr. Kamal Halbawi. He lives in London. He has a major center. He appeared on English CNN so many times. So these guys are very smart. This man has a PhD from the American University in Cairo. He's been living in the West for 20 years. Now he can go to Egypt. He had not been able to go for 20 years or so. So basically, these people are very smart. They are global in perspective. They understand American foreign policy and Israeli foreign policy. But I think that it will take them like 4 or 5 years to navigate the power within Egyptian society. I think that there will be a major power share in Egyptian politics in a matter of a few years. And this will have major effects on the Palestine-Israel conflict, on America, on Egypt and the USA, on Egypt and the Gulf states. Because the Gulf states are extremely upset with what has been going on in Tunisia as well as in Egypt. Now, of course, the people from Dubai and Saudi Arabia lost so much in Tunisia. They had invested so much money in Tunisia. They have invested even more money in Egypt. They have lost most of that money. So they are pretty nervous about what might happen to them. The Gaddafi of Libya is extremely nervous. But I think that Gaddafi has been there since 1969, 41 years so far. Because of the thin population of Libya, I think he would be able to manage. But Algeria would not be
able to. Well, his women's guard is
pretty... That's right. Yeah. But I think that majority of our countries will have major problems. And the likely candidates for, you know, an internal revolt are Algeria, Yemen, Jordan, Bahrain, Morocco, perhaps.
But this has been framed by so many as a kind of domino effect of people's desire for democracy. How do you frame it?
And also, yeah, that's what the Muslim Brothers are framing.
That's how they frame it.
Yes.
But they picked up on the discourse.
That's right.
They're happy to have it framed that way.
Yeah. But they know that the West is not sincere about democracy. Yes?
El Baradei is one name that sort of sticks in my mind since the Atomic Energy Board. And you see him as having a moderating effect on whatever happens in Egypt?
El Baradei, because of his long absence from Egypt, does not have any mass support in Egypt. He's supported by a few educated people. But he does not have a mass organization such as the Muslim Brotherhood movement. He's a voice who is well known internationally because of his role, as you said, in the atomic energy. But and he's a courageous man. But people think that, you know, he's coming back to hijack the revolution. So he does not have much credibility amongst the Egyptian masses.
They think he's Ignatius.
So how do you, I'm back to Tiffany's question before with Iran.
Yeah,
so back to the question of the Iranian Revolution in 79. So democracy as one pole, Khomeini-style theocracy as the other pole, where do you see things shaking out in Egypt in 5 years? Or
in 5 years, I think that we will have... a government that will be shared primarily by the Muslim Brothers, by the army and the youth in Egyptian society. But the Muslim Brothers, who have been banned for a long time, will play a major role. In terms of democracy, you know, I don't buy that argument. You know, the West has not supported democracy. Now, whether or not the Egyptians will form their own brand of democracy, Arab, Egyptian, Islamic democracy, that's another matter. But nevertheless, I think that the Muslim Brothers, you know, the West has to learn how to deal with the Muslim Brotherhood movement. I don't think it's a scary organization. I think that it's a political organization in addition to being religious. It knows how to make deals, but it will never make any major deal with Israel.
it might make deals with the USA, but not with Israel.
Why?
Why? Because of, you know, the Israeli occupation and the fact, you know, that since 9/11, Israel has carried the banner of fighting against Islamic terrorism. So terrorism and Islam have been synonymous in the media discourse in Israel as well as in the West. So the Muslim brothers, you know, if they are, they would be branded by Israel as being terrorists and international terrorists, and they will never make a deal with Israel because of this, but also because of the Israeli occupation of Muslim land, which is a significant fact.
And Dr. Abirami, if that is settled, they will negotiate with Israel.
If that is settled, what? If Israel pulls out of the West Bank and Gaza?
Yes, that's right.
But Israel doesn't want to pull out. That's the.
Well, you never know.
Well, I have known at least since 1948. Now, what will happen in the future? You know, I think that the Israeli state has been contracting a bit, and there are different problems within the Israeli state. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this talk is not about Israel. One major problem is that it is to the benefit of Israel to maintain animosity and enmity with the Arab and the Muslim world as a way of making Israeli society more coherent and more controlled by the Ashkenazi Jews against the Russian Jews and the Sephardic Jews, who are the majority of Israeli society. So it is not in the interest of Israel to make peace. But however, Israel has exhausted the USA and Europe. You know, Europe and the USA have lost because of Israel and Israeli policy and Israeli occupation. And 9/11, as you know, I mean, one major reason for 9/11 had been Palestine and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. And the Israelis have been relentless in refusing to acknowledge these facts by saying, oh, these are terrorists because Islam is a terrorist religion, Arabs are terrorists, they killed their brothers and sisters, whatever. So will Israel compromise its Zionist ideals? So far it has not compromised. On the contrary, it has moved more and more to the right, to conservatism than ever. It is much more conservative. You know, Israel is ruled by a new conservative, almost fascist regime nowadays. So will Israel modify that? I doubt it. Because Israelis have lived in a state of fear since 1948 for all sorts of reasons, one of which is the Holocaust, but that's not the only reason. And they think that they are surrounded by enemies. They think it's impossible to dialogue with Arabs and Palestinians, Christians or Muslims. This is the type of ideology that is driving the Israeli state nowadays. Israeli liberalism has contracted in a major way. Israeli liberals are leaving the country. Those who are forced to migrate to Israel are forced because of economic conditions such as in Russia or Ethiopia, such as the Falasha Jews. People who migrate to Israel nowadays do not migrate out of conviction in Zionism, such as in the 1950s and 60s. There were lots of liberal Jews from England, from Australia, from the USA, and from Canada who migrated to Israel, but this is not the case nowadays. So Israel has become a major fortress. Will Israel change its mind? That is not likely in the coming 5 to 10 years. You know, that's a very complicated discussion. You know, there are lots of major studies on that, and I would like to refer you to a major Israeli sociologist from the Hebrew University, Baruch Kimmerling, who wrote The Invention and the Decline of Israelness, where he talks about this complexity within Israeli society and the inability of the Israeli state to make peace with the Arabs for two major reasons, according to Kimmerling. The first major reason is because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state, and second, because Israel defines itself as a military state. So both the military and Jewishness are alive within the Israeli state, and they will never compromise. So far, they have never compromised. You know, Israel was established by Ben-Gurion, who came from the liberal establishment. But Ben-Gurion is no more. It is now the Likud. It's very conservative. It is the Jabotinsky philosophy, the Iron War philosophy that is ruling Israel. It's a philosophy that believes that Arabs can be treated only with force. They understand only the language of force, the language of wall building and all of that. So I haven't seen a liberalization in Israeli society in the past 10 to 15 years. It's becoming much worse than before, and that's the end of the story. Thank you very much.
You were just saying in 5 years you saw perhaps a combination of sharing of power, and you
yes.
and the Muslim brothers yes. were in that mix. And so my question, I think about democracy in the West, certainly in North America, where the youth exactly are not involved. We know that there's a great deal of lack of participation.
Yes.
So I guess my question is, and I'm not trying to be like pie in the sky, like totally unrealistic, but could it be that Egypt, in their growing towards a different way of democratizing than supposedly, you know, the democracy of the West, could find a different way that could teach us who are stuck inside of such such a corporate in link, really are the corporate powers that make decisions and run so much of how we do democracy, that sort of keeps us quiet, keeps the public happy.
That's a major question. You know, the impact of globalization on Western youth and how this impact is different from the youth in the Muslim world. That's a major question, and it could be answered in so many different ways, except to say, let me just tell you one anecdote. When I came to the USA in 1980, you know, I came from Beer Zeit University, which is on the occupied West Bank. So, you know, in Beer Zeit, we used to struggle with the Israeli army. They would throw tear gas at us and all that. Some students would be killed by the army. So I come to the University of Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, may God not plant you in the state of Ohio, you know. Anyway, so I come to Ohio, and I discovered that the youth, you know, my classmates, they were not interested in politics at all. You know, I told them, do you know where Israel is? You know, no one even heard of Israel, you know, or Palestine, worse, or Pakistan. They thought Palestine was Pakistan, something like that. Then, you know, they would invite me to a disco at the end of the week, and I said, that's the preoccupation of American youth, is to go to to a disco to pick up a boyfriend or a girlfriend and all of that. Now, I think, you know, the scenario is different here because of the difference in society. And because, perhaps, of materialism in this type of society. Of course, there are poor in the USA, in Canada, in the Western world. There are some poor people, lots, I don't know, 20-30%. But I don't think that it is as acute as it is in Egypt or Morocco or Tunisia or Pakistan or Indonesia. I think that, of course, this is a class society. But still, the middle class is somewhat strong. But this is not the case in the majority of the Muslim world. The middle class has been almost obliterated, except in Turkey. In Turkey, the middle class is very powerful. And the Islamists have come from the middle class in Turkey. The Muslim brothers represent not the countryside. They represent the middle class in Egyptian society.
And urban.
Whereas in the Muslim world, the middle class has been extremely weakened by the avarice of the elites, of the wealthy in society, the 2% in society or so. This is very true across the board in the Muslim world. So the youth have a different role to play, perhaps. But of course, you know, in the so-called democratic countries, we had our problems in the 1960s with the youth, with the student revolt in France, in the USA, in England, in the West. The West is going through a major crisis nowadays. I don't want to go on talking about that, but I believe that the fact that the USA launched a major war against terror, a universal war against terror, in order to avoid dealing with so many social and economic problems and race issues in American society. Because if you look at the American army in Iraq or Afghanistan, there's a substantial number who are African-American or Hispanic, who have been drawn by the American army, who have been made to forget about their social and economic and race problems in American society by beating Arabs or Muslims. And I was able to see that. I lived in South Korea 20 years ago, and there's a substantial American army. There are lots of African Americans in the army in South Korea, where they define themselves as purely Americans vis-a-vis the native South Koreans, that they feel that they are much better. Whereas in America, they don't feel much better as American. In Korea, they do, vis-a-vis the natives. So I think that there's a major crisis in American empire nowadays, and perhaps 9/11 has prolonged the life of American empire by launching two unsuccessful wars so far against two poor Arab countries and Muslim countries in the case of Afghanistan. Yes.
I'm just curious if it's possible that the decline on use of Islam in the States is possibly a response to the loss of American credibility. So if they're able to keep making Islam look bad, then it legitimizes.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's not the case with Barack Obama, because Barack Obama has tried to camouflage the intentions of American empire. And, you know, I was in Syria when Barack Obama was elected. David knows our friends in Syria, and they were able to quickly capture that by saying that the American Pentagon and the American institutions that have attacked the Muslim world are placing a black president at the top, but he has no power at all. They are still the same institutions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Barack Obama did not fool many Muslims, especially because he did not support democracy except in words. So, you know, he went to Cairo a year and a half ago. He spoke about democracy and all of that, but nothing has come out of this. And also, we must not
understand that speech is what has launched the democratic movement in Egypt.
I don't think so, yes. But also, we must not underestimate the power of Zionism, not only in Israel, but in the American political establishment. I think that the American political establishment has not been able to find ways to escape from the clutches of Zionism. Zionism is such a powerful movement. But of course, that's going to backfire in the long run, I believe, against Zionism. But it is such a powerful movement where Zionism prefers Israel to the security of the USA. We know about the Pollard case and other cases of the Israeli lobby where they would spy on the USA on behalf of Israel. So these are major problems that we face in the U.S., that the U.S. is not able to stand up to Zionism or to the Israeli state or to somebody like Netanyahu in power in Tel Aviv.
Does that speak to your question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Want to follow up on it?
Well, this, with the media is such a powerful thing in the States, so if the American population starts to learn all these other aspects of Islam, not just...
I think that the Americans have become much more conscious of what's being done in their names since 9/11 than before. Much more conscious and much more critical of... Especially because America has gone bankrupt financially. And, you know, who's going to bankroll the U.S. forever? The Saudis, they have to bankroll now Mubarak and Bin Ali and other presidents who might be exiled in the coming 12 months or so. China, India. So these countries, you know, they might bankroll the U.S. for another 10 years, 20 years. And then what? What will we do? Because there's a major financial issue in the USA that, you know, the bankers, the big bankers have become the major thieves in the country in the name of the Constitution. And is it possible now to remake and reform the American financial system? This is one problem. But the second problem is the spending of the Pentagon. It's in the trillions of dollars, 30% of the American budget. The Pentagon has influences all over the world in terms of armies and CIA and all that. So that's going to have negative impacts in the short run and the long run in the USA. So we're stopping, huh?
We have one more here.
Yes. I was just wondering, because we're talking about like the media and it's kind of multiple times, and then as I look at Borgia, it tends to pop out at me. I was wondering if you could kind of discuss the difference between the popular media representation of jihad and how it's been used by these organizations versus the Quranic meaning of jihad.
Yeah. That's a very good question. Thank you for it. You know, the Quranic meaning of jihad has to be understood in a specific Quranic context, because the Quran does talk about jihad in a military sense, but also in a spiritual sense, you know. And for the Sufis who believe in text and community, they would elevate the meaning of spiritual jihad at the expense of military or violent jihad. Now, I believe that the Quran, you know, just like in any other revelation, in Islam, in the study of the Quran, in Quranic exegesis, we have what we call the circumstances of revelation, that every verse has a special circumstance or condition behind it. So let's say when the Quran says, and fight the kuffar, fight the unbelievers, the Quran means the unbelievers of Mecca who fought against the prophetic mission for at least 12 years in the life of the Prophet. Now, therefore, the problem of the exegete is how to extend that argument to the modern day, to apply this to the modern day. And the jihadists, the people, you know, Bin Laden and Qaeda, you know, many of them have been excellent Quranic exegetes, interpreters of the Quran, because they have been able to extend the argument to the present condition. And many of them understand the subtlety of international relations, and the, for them the fact that the Muslim world has been exploited by the USA and its own clients, like the Saudi king. And they speak about the official religious establishment as, you know, those who sing for the choir of the king, so to speak, in order to allow the king and his cronies to exploit the country on behalf of the USA and Western power. But they have interpreted the Quran in such a way to say that, you know, we have to use the Quran in order to resist the king, even the religious establishment, before we can resist the USA. So it depends, you know, it depends on the way they have understood the text. And they have understood the text in this way, that the Quran is not just a passive text of piety or spirituality. It's a relevant text to the modern conditions, and Muslims have to take use of that. Now, the popular mass media, let's say in the West, you know, I'm sure that you may have read Edward Said's Covering Islam. It's an older book that came out in 1981 that talks about the way the American mass media had covered Iran and Islam in Iran up to the Islamic Revolution of Khomeini and all of that. In a way that Khomeini was, you know, coming from the dark ages, he was such a ferocious, brutal force, and he stands against the West, human rights, women rights, and this and that. This is what the mass media has been saying. And this is what the conservative mass media, of course, you know, here we have a liberal mass media, but the problem with the liberals is that they are ambivalent. You know, one day they sleep with their wives, the second day they sleep with their mistresses. You know, that's the problem with the liberals. So the liberal mass media has not been disciplined and organized in the portrayal of events in the Muslim world. Because if they stuck to democracy in a real sense, like, you know, I think that the most brilliant Western commentator on Islam is the British journalist from the Independent newspaper, Robert Fisk, F-I-S-K. You really have to read Robert Fisk. He wrote three major books, and he was in Tahrir Square all of this period, reporting from Cairo directly to the Independent newspaper. There's a lot of other people, too. I mean, committed Americans or Westerners who understand what's and who speak, you know, Islamic, Arabic, the Arabic language, and who know the Islamic tradition, all of that. But these are not in the majority. I would say they are the 10% of the Western mass media. Because, you know, when you, a reporter from the New York Times, you know, I was listening to what these reporters were saying, you know, they did not know where to stand exactly. They didn't know whether to support the democracy of the youth or to support the Mubarak regime. Whereas somebody like Robert Fisk would give you a brilliant analysis of the social and economic and religious forces of Egyptian society from 1952 until the present time, and the regression in the rule and the behavior of the ruling elites from 1952 until the Mubarak regime. The fact that the Mubarak regime was decided by 2,000 men only, who controlled 80% of the resources in Egyptian society, with alliances with Israel, with the Gulf states, with the USA, with Europe, who did not care about the life of the poor of Egyptian society. So the mass media in the West would not talk about this in such a way, except some committed Western journalists, one of whom is Robert Fisk.
So if I could just, is that satisfactory?
I mean, what I got out of it
in reference to your question was that jihad is also, from a Quranic perspective, it is your resistance to oppression.
Yeah.
And that's something that the modern media doesn't really see very much. Adele, did you have your hand up? I mean, my sister usually gets the last word in the panel. And then we'll bring it to an end.
I was just wondering what you saw as the place for women in the Muslim Brotherhood.
they have a very strong women's branch in the Muslim Brotherhood movement, and the leader of that branch, I think that she's still alive, she wrote her memoirs. I forget the title, but they have been translated into English. But they have a very active sisters branch in the Muslim Brotherhood. Very active. Yes. The Muslim Brotherhood is a very strong organization in the Muslim world nowadays. Yeah.
I know David's going to say something, but I just have to get in here. I so appreciate how you make things more complicated and therefore help us to understand better.
You know, I just started, you know, because I did not say what I wanted to say.
You're just warming up, I know. We have sleeping bags in the corner, so we always...
When
Ibrahim comes. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much.